Sam Goodwin, entrepreneur, speaker, author. Thanks for coming in today. A fellow St. Louisan who, took the long route to get all the way back into this seat today. But tell me what you do, Sam.
Yeah, thanks, Shep. Thanks for having me. So today I live in Washington, D.C., but originally from and grew up here in St. Louis, so happy to be back. And for the local listeners, I'll just answer the question right now. I went to DeSmet High School,
right,
along with my two younger brothers as well. And today I run my own speaking business. So I speak full-time, also do coaching on people who want to get into the speaking industry. And that's where my professional time and effort is today.
And okay, so you're based out of D.C. or D.C. area, and so you speak around. Who are you speaking to in general?
Yeah, so my primary theme is uncertainty, and most of my work is with corporate audiences, conferences, conventions, leadership retreats, a range of different groups. Essentially, I was pushed to a point of overwhelming uncertainty, truly life or death. My presentations are narrative-driven and include these dramatic elements of my stories, but also weave in and conclude with key principles that I think we can all implement into our own personal, professional, even spiritual lives. So I was pushed to this point of overwhelming uncertainty, but through that I learned some things that have helped me and some things that I think can help all of us.
Yeah, because that's a tough thing to suss out, and we deal with it daily, whether it's it could be all forms. So you talked about overwhelming uncertainty, experience that you had. So we could kind of jump into that, which is, what are the circumstances that you found yourself in and of being faced with this uncertainty? And you can jump into that anywhere you want, but just to kind of get people to end in mind, which is what happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as I mentioned, originally from here in St. Louis, throughout most of my childhood and teenage years, I played competitive hockey. Was fortunate to have some success with the sport and went on to play Division I in college at Niagara University. When I graduated there in 2012, I had the opportunity to take my first professional job in Singapore. And I originally only planned to be in Singapore for about 3 months, but I ended up staying for 6 years. And it was fantastic.
Basically 23 to 29 or 20, like.
So from 2012 to 2018.
Okay.
Those years. And it was a fantastic opportunity, a great way to begin my professional career. I was working for a tech startup business and an NGO, a nonprofit that was doing development work around Southeast Asia. And throughout this time, I traveled as much as I could. I was in the heart of Southeast Asia, had a little bit of flexibility in my work schedule, had the world's best airport in my backyard. And
right.
I took advantage of the opportunity to explore as much of the region and beyond as possible. And
did that surprise you that you found yourself wanting to do that? I mean, you basically had been going from rink to rink for a bit, got your first job, and you're in Singapore. How did you get, where did this bug come from that, you know what, I'm going to start bouncing around and see? Did that surprise you that you found yourself there?
Throughout most of my life, as you mentioned, most of my travel was around traveling for hockey, or getting in my parents' van and going from St. Louis to Chicago to Detroit, wherever we were going. But when I moved overseas, kind of the perspective changed a little bit. Singapore is such a melting pot, people from all over the world, food from all over the world. And it was just this unrelenting curiosity that really drove me to travel. And I don't know where that came from, but I think it's been there since I was a kid. And that time really gave me the opportunity to jump on that and try to learn and better understand the world. And Singapore, as I mentioned, just its location was this great place to be based in order to experience new places.
I mean, you hadn't had an open weekend in forever. So you're like, what do I do? Like, usually I'm playing hockey right now.
For sure. And kind of the thing to do for the expats there was to travel, to experience the region and have those opportunities. So that's kind of how that adjusted.
And so it wasn't part of, you weren't a 10, 12-year-old thinking, someday I'm going to travel the globe.
No, it was. So I had just a personal preference when I traveled. I didn't like to repeat places.
Okay.
And so the next weekend, the next holiday, the next opportunity I had, I would just go somewhere different. And I put this formula into play for about 6 years. And it was in early 2018 when I realized that I had traveled to about 120 countries in the world. And it was at this point when I remember thinking, well, how many are there? I had always traveled because it was fun and I enjoyed it. But most importantly, I learned from it. Travel was the best education I'd ever had. It was never about ticking boxes or checking places off a list.
So you kind of turned around one day and you're like, I've been a lot of places at this point.
Right. And it was always organic. To answer your question, it was never like from the beginning, oh, I'm going to travel to every country in the world. It was always about learning and better mm-hmm. understanding people. But I got to this point, I did a little bit of research and learned that there are 193 fully recognized UN sovereign states. And so I thought to myself, well, maybe I could go to all of them. And the competitive athlete in me likes setting goals and working toward achieving them, et cetera. So
no, I get it.
I started doing some more research, started looking at quite a few different things. I began with a map, my bank account, people who I knew in different places who might be able to help, visas that I might need. And
yeah, you're like, I'm not going to be at the Ritz if I do this.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so ultimately decided that I was going to give this a shot. And I had no idea if I could do it. I might fail miserably. I don't even know what that would look like, but I became committed to working toward achieving something that I thought was extraordinary.
Yeah. And so, it sounds like, you put the preparation in to get it and be successful, but you didn't kind of overthink it at the same time. You're like, well, I've already come this far, and it wasn't foolish or anything. You're like, no, this is legitimate. I've come this far. I'm going to sketch this out. I'm checking out my bank account. Let's make this a success.
It was a combination of research and sketching things out. And I think the most important advice that I would give to anyone who wants to travel is research and be prepared. At the same time, a lot of my thought process was just go.
Sure.
Just go and start and see what happens. And so it was kind of this balance of managing this research and all the safety concerns that I thought, and also just taking action and going.
And so is this something you're communicating to your folks along the way?
Yep. So I feel fortunate to say my parents have always been very supportive. And in fact, I should tell a quick story. When I finished college and first was considering going to Singapore, I remember talking to my father and I said, I was telling him about this. And I wasn't sure. I was a kid from the Midwest. I was like, Asia, this is crazy. I don't even know why I pursued this. I would never move to Singapore, move to Asia.
Yeah.
But then I thought about it a little bit more and started talking to my parents. And I'll never forget, my dad said to me, he said, Sam, if you go to Singapore and things don't work out, you can always come home.
True.
And that was kind of this light bulb and this safety net, which was basically like the foundation of my adulthood. Because I remember thinking to myself, well, the worst thing that happens is I'm right back where I am right now. So, okay, I'm going to give this a shot. Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's go. And so there was a little bit of that 6 years later when I started this, when the style of travel changed a little bit. But I'm just so grateful to my parents, my father for giving me that kind of perspective.
Yeah. And allowing that runway to figure some stuff out, but go do your thing.
I think oftentimes we're in situations where we're unsure, there's uncertainty, but if we remember that the worst thing that happens is we're in the same situation we're in right now, it's not so bad.
Yeah. I mean, it's sometimes the worst thing you can do is let the brain get in the way of the reflex arc.
Yeah. Well said. Exactly.
Just throw the ball to first. Don't overthink it.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you're in Singapore, you've been there, you're traveling all over the place and you're thinking, hey, I'm kind of on a tear here. Maybe I'll try and do all of them. And you discover there's 193 UN recognized countries.
That's right.
So now you've got a short list. you know, sort of. So how do you set out on this?
Yeah. So at that point, my style of travel changed a little bit, and that's because the goal had temporarily changed. And I don't necessarily recommend the style of travel that I was doing in that sort of home stretch of this journey. I maybe wasn't spending as much time as I would in a certain place, or moving a little bit faster, which is fine because the goal was different. But that was essentially how I started. I said I'm just gonna go.
Yeah.
I'm gonna start.
What do you pack for something like that?
I packed a North Face backpack, and whatever I could fit in there, that's what I took.
Okay, that was the constraint.
And I left and I went, and it felt crazy and irresponsible. I was 28 or 29 years old. Shouldn't I be doing things that are more, you know, there's all these societal parameters and
started thinking.
Right. But I also had this deal with myself. I said, I'm going to travel to the rest of these places. I'm going to get these experiences, perspectives, and then I'm going to go back to my career and focused on that. That was the deal that I made with myself, but it was also what I wanted. I didn't want to just kind of roam around, you know, forever or aimlessly. And there's nothing wrong with that. It just wasn't for me. I said, I'm going to do this. I estimate it's going to take about a year, and then I'm going to get back to my career. So I'm going to take this kind of gap year, a decade too late, so to speak.
Right.
But that's what I cared about. That's what I wanted to do. And so I just said yes, and I went.
Did it feel like a non-option to you?
Yes, because I knew that if I didn't do it, I would always wonder how it was. And I feared regret a lot more than I feared failure.
God, that sounds familiar. I know that feeling on one hand.
Absolutely. You know, as an entrepreneur.
Like, yeah, it's like, you know, just go do it. Don't be a sissy here. Just go do it.
Yeah.
So you had to walk in, tell the boss, peace, I'm out of here for a year.
Sure. And I had been working for this company. There was kind of some uncertainty with the business, as there are with so many startups. And yeah. I'd been there for 6 years, and it was just kind of time for the next chapter.
Okay. So it wasn't, I'll be back in a year. It was like, I'm done here.
It was like, I'm going to do this and then going to see how SS. Things look. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So where was the first stop? Just if you're, we have to go through each stop, but where was the first, I'm out of here and here I'm going?
Yep. So I actually temporarily relocated some of my things to the UAE, to Dubai. I had some friends there, and that was sort of my base for the next year. Partly because I had some friends there, but also more so because of its geographic location. It was closer to a lot of the places that I hadn't been to yet. A lot in Africa and that region. And so during that time, I sort of based myself in Dubai, and I started this business. I was giving skating lessons to the kids of local expats there.
Okay.
And it wasn't really a sustainable business, but it was...
what was needed.
It was what was needed at the time, and it allowed me to travel and have that year there.
So when I think about this, there were probably, if you created a heat map as well, there were probably like danger zones, safe zones. How am I going to thread the needle through all of these countries so that, you know, I get my best result? Because they're known. It's like in any major metro area, you know, there's, you know, if someone's asked me, how do I get through whatever town? I'm like, well, you're going to want to stay kind of on this path. So you were aware of those kind of hot zones.
Yeah, for sure. For me, safety was always the top priority, as much as it can be on a journey like this. I don't think it's cool to be in unsafe situations. I don't go looking for trouble. One of the most significant ways that I found to ensure safety was to follow the path of other travelers, and that kind of aligns to your question about knowing where these places are. So just researching and being aware. I spent a lot of time doing that.
So the trip's going well. You start off and that you've hit your 121st country, and then you're off. You're like, you're because you'd hit 120 in 2018, and you started the journey. So start walking us through how the journey's going and how you're refining it and getting through it, and you know, ultimately where you end up for, you know, a 63-day period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So over the next year, about a year after I left Singapore, I had traveled to 180 of 193 countries with my North Face backpack. And it was, a lot of those were in Africa. I did make it back out to the South Pacific, but I was, I was done with, I had traveled to every country in Asia except for country 181, which was Syria. And this is a place that is incredibly culturally, religiously significant. It's the cradle of civilization. It's mentioned more than 300 times in the Bible. And Damascus is the oldest continuously inhabited capital in the world, a place that I really wanted to visit and was excited about. At the same time, it's a place that's experiencing arguably the most tragic humanitarian disaster of our lifetime. By conservative estimates, 500,000 people have died in the conflict. The UN stopped counting at 250,000. But one of the most significant things that I learned through my travels is that places that are negatively perceived, or that Western media tells us we're not supposed to like, These were the same places where I had many of my best experiences and where my perspectives were most meaningfully impacted. So despite everything that was happening in Syria, I was confident that the same would be the case.
The same pattern of kind of what we might think of it was not what it was.
Exactly. And on May 25th, 2019, I went to the northeast region of Syria. I went to a town called Qamishli. And just 2 hours after arriving, I was walking through a roundabout on the way to meet up with my guide when all of a sudden a black pickup truck abruptly pulled up next to me. Two armed men jumped out of the back seat and instructed me to get inside. And thankfully, they weren't violent, but I didn't have a choice. This is happening. I was scared, confused. I had no information or anyone to help. I was desperately trying to understand what was happening. And these men were loyal to the Syrian president at the time, Bashar al-Assad. And They told me that they were skeptical about my travel history and my travel motives. And as we sped down back alleys of the city, the officers in that vehicle, they accused me of espionage, of being an American spy and collaborating with terrorists. And nothing like this had ever happened to me before.
So you're understanding what's being said to you?
I was understanding words here or there. Their English was pretty broken,
but I did understand a few. You certainly understood what was occurring, likely, but you did get enough out of them to be like, you know, you're a spy, and you know, we don't like the reasons you're here and where you've been.
Mm-hmm. They were very skeptical.
And how? So this truck pulls up to you. You're just kind of getting into town, And it pulls right up next to you. Did you notice that was occurring, or you turned and you're like, oh shit?
Yeah, it all happened very quickly. I was actually on, I talk about this in my book, which I'll mention a lot of the stuff around kind of travel and what happened in Syria. I wrote a book about this that I published with the Shed. It's called Saving Sam. And a lot of these details are in there. But I was actually on the phone with my mom. I was on FaceTime with my mom when I was kidnapped. And so she, you know, witnessed some of this. But it all happened very quickly, and it was just right on the street.
Yeah, so you're swept away, and based on, and you, there's a book, Saving Sam. So we, you know, the more granular details, I think we should refer people to the book. But in a general sense, you're taken as far as you can tell. Like, how soon do you know that you're in a prisoner versus kind of situation versus, hey, we're just going to detain you for a couple minutes, scare the shit out of you, and then get you out of here?
I didn't know that. I had no information. And all in the early kind of days, all these, you had just a range of things going through my mind. There's this kind of like kidnapping, like runway here where it goes from like, from shock to fear to confusion to anger, working through all of these different emotions. At the same time, I'm thinking that at some point, you know, Ashton Kutcher is going to swing open the cell door and say, you know, you got punked, right? All these things are just burning off in my brain. So there's a lot of different emotions that are involved with that. But I didn't have any information about what was going on.
All right. So this is, you know, it's kind of like Taken, you know, you will be taken sort of moment where like this is just happening. And you're held captive 63 days in total. And without digging too much into that, because I think that the text is a better place to get all of that. But what can you tell us about that 63 days without getting too into the details of just sort of maybe the mental ebb and flow of that? And it's, you know, there were segments of where you were by yourself for a long time and then, you know, you were moved. And what ultimately led to you getting out of there?
Yep. So I was held for, as you mentioned, for 9 weeks, for 63 days. And my time was, it turned out to be essentially split in half. So the first 27 days I was held in solitary confinement. The next month I was held in a more of a general population facility with lots of other men. And both of these had their very different variables to them. Solitary confinement is torture. It's a cruel tactic that's been used by captors for centuries. If I told you, Shep, that so I often say the most challenging part of the situation was the uncertainty. And what I mean by that is if I told you that you were going to go and be put in a underground prison cell, you were going to be given bread and boiled potatoes and water to eat. You were not going to be physically harmed, although you'll hear other people being tortured. And on day 27, you're going to be taken out of there and moved somewhere else. Now, I'm not saying that you would be comfortable, but what I am saying is that you would be in a totally different situation knowing the finish line, knowing that you need to get to 27 days and you'll be out. And for me, I didn't have that. And so all of these potential outcomes were, based on the information I had, I believed they were all possible. So was I going to be in that, was I going to be in that cell forever? I thought that was possible. Was I going to be released in 1 minute? I thought that was possible. Was I going to be released in a week? Were they going to open the door and shoot me or torture me or stop feeding me? Based on the information I had, I believed that all of these potential outcomes were possible, and trying to entertain them 24/7 was emotionally and psychologically exhausting. That's why I say the most challenging part was the uncertainty, and that's what I talk about today. And not to go too far into it, but there were three key things that helped me embrace and manage that uncertainty. And the first was to lean into gratitude, find things to be grateful for. The second was to control and take action, control things that I could control. And the third was to recognize the uncertainty of the situation as an opportunity. And it was this framework, these three things in that order, that helped me win through this uncertain time. And that's what I talk about today. And so I can talk
is
more,
that,
more
yeah,
about
I'd
that.
Like to yeah. hear more about that, but was that on the job training for you? Meaning that had you ever thought about your life in just sort of, hey, be a grateful guy, you know, look for the good stuff. And, you know, was any of that, or it's like, no, okay, yesterday sucked. I got to start building some structure some way, somehow.
It was arrangement. I found strength and put this framework together as a result of so many different life experiences. And a lot, we were talking before this episode about the skills and traits that are developed through being a competitive athlete. Yep. And that was something where I found a lot of strength, the mental toughness, critical thinking, resilience. We hear CEOs or business leaders say all the time that they like to hire athletes. And I thought about the coaches that I had had and how they instilled these things into me that helped in that situation. But I leaned on all kinds of things for strength. I leaned on perspectives that I developed from traveling to different corners of the world, which provoked gratitude for just the basic food and water I was being given. I leaned on these skills and traits from a life of playing competitive hockey. I leaned on a belief that I had a purpose in life and a desire to see family and friends again. For me, nothing was more important than my faith, which is a whole other conversation. From a spiritual standpoint, I believe this wasn't the end and there was more. So all of these things together were where I kind of developed this framework and something that I talk about today. And so it wasn't something that I had coming in. It was just something that it was forced to develop as a result of hitting rock bottom, literally and figuratively.
And do you ever feel like, so I believe in everything you just said in different contexts, of course, but did you ever feel like, no, I'm just deceiving myself to get through this, and it sort of crumbled your plan? Do you know what I'm saying?
For sure. It was a roller coaster. It didn't work smoothly like that. And right. It took me time to get to that place. And it was just an emotional roller coaster every day. So totally agree with that.
Do you lose track of time?
Something that I learned quickly was that maintaining an emotional and psychological connection to the outside was very important, because I had no window. It was all concrete. I had nothing but this small blanket to lay on the concrete floor as a bed. There were two ways that I kept track of time. One was I had to request to go to the bathroom, and I would bang on the door and it would usually let me. And the bathroom
that
was
seems
just
like an odd courtesy.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So the bathroom was just this small hole in the concrete floor, few steps outside the cell door. But from that hole, I could look up and see this small window to the outside.
Wow.
So I started trying to time my bathroom requests with when I thought there was a change from day to night, so that I could confirm. And the other thing that I did was I started to identify a path or a schedule on when food was being brought. So I thought, I think I'm getting this in roughly the morning and getting this in roughly the evening, and started basically like cross-referencing the information from the bathroom visits and the food. And then I chipped this rock off the inside of the cell wall, and I carved a calendar into the cell wall, and I would cross off days when I would go to sleep. And that became super important to maintain this connection to the outside. And I guess I'll just also quickly mention, since I'm in St. Louis today, as I mentioned, I grew up playing hockey here my whole life, and this was in the summer of 2019. And as the local listeners will likely remember, in the summer of 2019, the Blues won the Stanley Cup, and this all...
We didn't see it coming.
may not have seen it coming, but these things overlapped, so that overlapped with my situation. And so I missed all of that, but one of the things that I did early on was actually on my calendar. I mentioned I would mark the days when I knew the Blues were playing, and
wow.
And it's I have to kind of preface this by saying, like, I was in a situation where I frankly did not care about a hockey team. I mean, it was so far down the priority list. I was much more concerned about whether I was going to die, and probably in a pretty gruesome way. And how is my family, and what's going to happen? What's happening to these people next to me who are being tortured? All these things. So in the grand scheme of things, hockey and the Blues were way down the priority list, but there was some strength that was found in using that as a way to connect with the outside world.
Yeah.
And so I found strength emotionally in that connection during that time.
You were probably kind of like dreaming up plays that might be happening at that moment.
100%. 100%. And psychologically, anything I could do to take my brain outside of the cell was incredibly important.
Wow, there's a lot of metaphor that can be applied here. But to one question I'm thinking is, you're there. Do you have any sense of the person who's in the place next to you or next to you? Like, any clue how long they've been there?
I never saw another inmate in that facility.
You didn't.
However, it was not soundproof, so I would hear some things happening, but I never saw another inmate or learned their stories.
Yeah, and that's probably spine shivering types of things. But how did you get sprung out of this place? I mean, I literally can't imagine. It is the uncertainty. That's the maximum uncertainty, right? What you're discussing. And I guess one day the doors opened. I mean.
Yeah. So I was moved from solitary confinement after 27 days and moved to another facility for a month. And it was a general population with lots of other men. And unquestionably an upgrade from solitary confinement, but also had its own kind of challenges with just lack of privacy and lots of different personalities and a range of things. And grateful to say everybody there was, the other inmates were incredibly kind to me. And that's a whole other conversation about hospitality in the Middle East.
So you're like the general population sort of concept? Or?
Well, that's what I was in for that second month. And, Just a quick story. Could talk a lot about this, but about two weeks into that second month, one of the other inmates came to me. I went to him. I was talking to him, and I said, "Hey, you know, everybody here, meaning the other inmates, were being so nice to me." And I said, "It was just a little bit hard to know what to expect in a place like this." And I'll never forget. He said to me, "He said, Sam, in Syria, all the good people are here in prison because all the bad people are outside putting us in here." And so it gets to a larger geopolitical concept around the regime and authoritarian leaderships and all that. But
that's remarkable, isn't it?
It was a remarkable thing to hear, very sobering and a bit of a paradox. But, I've traveled every country in the world, and some of the best hospitality I've experienced anywhere has been across the Middle East, every country. And I'm confident that if I wouldn't have had this experience, this situation, that I would have had a fantastic experience in Syria as I did everywhere else in the region. And so this instance was a reminder of that. To get back to your question, it was on day 63, which I didn't know what was going on, but I was, long story short, my release had been granted as a result of the Lebanese internal security. Lebanese officials had mediated my release on my behalf, and my family had actually connected with them from here in the U.S., and I was driven out of Damascus to Beirut, the capital city of Lebanon, and when I arrived there, I went into the office of Lebanon's internal security, and in addition to dozens of government and military intelligence officials and journalists, when I walked into the office, also my parents were there, culminating this moment that was just indescribably emotional and one that many people thought would never happen, and a breath.
Must have knocked the wind out of you.
Absolutely. It was a breathtaking display of God answering prayers.
That's remarable. A lot to uncover there. But the book is Saving Sam. And so I'm going to assume it can be found in the normal channels. And as I said before, I wanted to hear this from you firsthand. And I'm going to be following this shortly with that. So let's talk about the book for a second. How did you get to that? I mean, I understand it's an experience, but it's not without pain. Was it driven, was it motivated primarily by, I've just got to kind of get this thing out of here and onto here? Was it a therapy sort of thing that got you there?
You're right. It was a combination of a few things. So one was I found that sharing the story was therapeutic, and that's where I am today with sharing story and message. Also, I believed from kind of a spiritual standpoint, I believe that it was given this for a reason, and that by sharing it in a meaningful way, it can be impactful to others. So that was there. And then the other dynamic that came into play pretty quickly was that I realized that what happened to me was really only half the story. Because when I was released, one of the most overwhelming things for me was learning about everything that happened on the outside while I was trapped on the inside, everything with my family and what they were dealing with. And so they have kind of their own story with their loved one going missing and on the other side of the world. And so the way that the book is set up, it's really two stories. So it's me trapped on the inside and my family on the outside. And so it's sort of like this Apollo 13-esque structure where there's this under-resourced entity stuck and then this group trying to help. And the difference is that in Apollo 13, they could talk to each other, but the structure is going to be the same. So it's really the way the book's set up is it's really two stories.
It's definitely two stories. I mean, their minds must have been running wild, just like yours. I mean, I think there were some that shook loose eventually, but basically none.
Totally. And oftentimes today, if I'm speaking at an event or a conference, sometimes I'll have my parents there, one of my siblings or someone. And when the audience finds out that they're there in the Q&A, they start getting questions.
I mean,
like the moms in the room, for example, want to ask my mom, well, what did you do? What were you thinking? What were your prayers? Who did you talk to? These different situations. So I often say that sometimes I feel like it should be them who are up on stage giving a presentation, because what happened to them is arguably as extraordinary. And so it's really two stories. And with any someone who's taken hostage or kidnapped or wrongfully detained around the world, it's not only the person who it happens to, but it's also their family and their loved ones who are being tortured as well. And so it's important to remember that that's going on.
Yeah, as a parent myself, you think about that. I'm like, I mean, I would go to lengths to try and get that solved. And that was probably a very difficult time, to say the least. So when you're thinking about the book, you have to pull out messaging, though. You've got to communicate something ultimately. And you sounds like you've settled on the concept of uncertainty and what that means. What are some of the other themes that people can be thinking about as they think through your story, but like, how can they apply? Uncertainty is a killer, but what other maybe are on the cutting room floor, almost made it, but didn't type of themes?
Essentially, I don't want to be known for the things that happened to me. I want to be known for the way I've responded to them.
Yeah.
And I hope that the readers of this book will empower readers to adopt a similar mindset and implement it into their own personal, professional or spiritual lives. And that's where my family and I are with this story right now.
What do you think? So you are out speaking and you interface a lot with people who probably share with you maybe something that's troubling them, or how am I getting past this, or and you look at them, how often is there just really not that much of an impediment that's actually in front of them?
Well,
which is a kind of hard question to answer, because you don't want to discredit their feelings in any way, but it's like, no, just push through that.
Yeah, I think, you know, we could be held hostage by anything: alcohol, drugs, illness, relationships, finances, injuries. But the way that we embrace and manage those challenges, the actions we take, I think that defines who we become and from where we begin again. And people ask me quite a bit, Sam, if you could go back, would you still travel the way you did, or would you do anything differently? And on one hand, I would never want to relive captivity and wouldn't wish that on anybody. But on the other hand, and I think more importantly, I would also never want to give up everything that's come from it. The opportunity to meet some remarkable people, to grow in character and in faith and in understanding really of the stuff in life that actually matters. And those two things go together, making it kind of a challenging question to answer sometimes.
Yeah. Uncertainty, in what forms are you seeing that? I mean, you're interfacing on a more corporate, you know, you're talking to corporations. What does that uncertainty look like? What would be sort of, here's an uncertainty of, is it about a project? Is it about a personal journey? Like, what are the uncertainties that you see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think if we're all honest with ourselves, we will say that our personality today, the very essence of our life, is a result of the challenges we've faced and the choices we made as a result of those challenges, not necessarily because of the good times that we've had. And I think that can just look different for anybody in our personal or professional lives. And it just looks different depending on the situation.
Yeah, that's sort of rubbing up against the idea that fear is what motivates us, right? And there are different ways of saying it, but there's what gets someone to move and gets them to do things is either the fear of what happens if they don't or the fear of what happens if they do.
For sure.
You know, and that's rising above that and, you know, the idea of courage on top of fear. All those seem to be sort of entangled.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And also the fear of what other people think,
which yeah.
I think oftentimes I say maybe the best advice I've ever been given is that the quickest way to be unhappy is to live our lives and make decisions based on other people's judgments.
It's a horrible idea. It really is, because if for no other reason, the memory is so short. Let's say you are inclined to get hung up on what someone might think. Don't think they're thinking about it for more than a day.
No.
Because, there's so much info flowing around these days. It's like, fine, maybe they cared for an afternoon.
I had a friend of mine say to me recently, he said, in my 20s, I really cared a lot about what other people thought. In my 30s, I started to not care as much. And then in my 40s, I realized that nobody ever thought about me anyways.
That's insightful. And it's one of those things that it can really thwart effort in a big way. Yeah. So stepping away a little bit, and I asked you this before, it just to kind of give you a moment to think about it, but was I believe in sort of these cosmic things and things. So was this always going to happen?
I don't think things happen to us. They happen for us. And although Syria doesn't define me, it has become a part of who I am. And a lot of people said my life was over, but in truth, it was just getting going.
Well, thank you to the people who said it's over, because now you had something to push against, right? It's like, oh, you just counted me out.
That's right.
You know, so thank you for doing that. But the idea, though, I don't know, I just look at different things, and the older I get, the more I'm just like, I'm not going to worry about it as much, because however you want to characterize it, there's a plan or there's a something, but I'm starting to think things are not as accidental or sort of disorganized as I once thought.
Yeah, that makes sense. Certainly for me, I mean, I view the world through a spiritual lens. I believe this happened for a reason, and probably be working for a while to uncover all of those details. But that's something that I think a lot about with this situation.
Yeah, they're not always evident in the moment. And it's how and how do you deal with wanting there's a desire to be like you can be pissed about this happening. Like, that's a reasonable thing to be like, God, you know, damn it. Why so how do you It's just, is it about just being mindful of taking kind of the high road? And because it's not, I don't think anyone faults you for being just kind of pissed.
Totally. I was pissed many times throughout this. I think we're all stronger and more resilient than we can imagine. And uncertain times are exactly what we need in order to grow. But we have to view it that way. It's a choice to view it that way.
Why is uncertainty so painful?
I think
there's a high stakes situation that you're in, but you have lower stakes situations now in your life, and we all do that maybe aren't there. But like, why is it so painful?
I would say uncertainty is a horrible thing to waste.
Okay, tell me about that.
As an athlete, entrepreneur, traveler, hostage, I believe there's value and opportunity in every experience. And so, going back to when I reflect on this situation, I just think when we lean into gratitude, when we control, we can control, when we recognize our challenges and uncertainty as an opportunity, when we adopt this framework, these three points in that order, we win and we grow through uncertain times.
How many people do you encounter that really haven't organized their thinking that way? Meaning that as I get older, I kind of share more of how I bucket my thinking with people because people shared it with me and you start. So is it your experience that a lot of people haven't been kind of exposed to like, okay, you can have an operating system of how you run the way you think. And it just seems like there are a lot of people who haven't, unfortunately, haven't been said, okay, here's a really, really productive way to be thinking about things. Mm-hmm. How common?
Yeah, I would need to think more about that and maybe live a few more years to come up with a good answer to that. But I think sharing our thoughts in the buckets of thinking can be really helpful to others. I mean, that's how I've come to a lot of the things that I've thought about today is listening to the way that other people think. So, but I don't know, I'd have to think a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, things aren't as amorphous as they may appear, right? And what there's a way to think about something, as you know, because you had to create scaffolding for yourself to get through something. Uncertainty to me is just the indicator of what I need to lean into, right? Meaning like the things that come into my life, that the discomfort, that's the direction I turn because I'm like, that's where the leak is.
Speaking of leaning into that, I think there's a big difference between what uncertainty feels like and what's actually happening.
Okay.
Can feel very chaotic, very confusing, but what's actually happening is a lot of growth, a lot of development, a lot of new perspectives, a lot of opportunities, but it doesn't feel that way. But so there's a big difference and discrepancy between how it feels and what's actually happening.
How might someone evaluate that?
Reflect. And when I look back on my life, all of the times when I've grown the most or seen the biggest changes in my life, it's always been because of uncertainty, because of something that felt really uncomfortable at the time. And it's kind of cliched to say those things, but if somebody hears people say that enough, hopefully they'll take the opportunity to recognize their challenges as that.
Yeah, and the great inconvenience is that happiness typically resides on the other side of that.
Other side of fear or uncertainty or some challenge, exactly.
And that's for me the motivator is I know that when I'm uncomfortable and I'm pushing through something, I think of it more as like I am on a path of getting some happiness.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Which I don't think that's intuitive.
No, I don't think it is. And maybe there's a little bit of a hot take, but as an entrepreneur, I often think that there's correlation between how on track you are to something extraordinary with how much people are saying no and making fun of you.
Right.
And that's important to recognize. I think there's a direct correlation there oftentimes.
I've said, and it's not a very organized thought, but sometimes...
I didn't say it very organized there.
Well, I've said things like, I know I'm on the right track when everyone's kind of heckling me about it. And now there is an evaluation needs to occur.
For sure.
Right?
For sure.
Like, I really might be walking off into the wilderness, but... an indicator of like, are we going in the right direction? And maybe that's an indicator of, you know, this is something that's original, it's occurring, and it's uncomfortable, and it means change. So you're getting, you know, shut down.
I totally agree. I mean, being, it's that saying, it's being an entrepreneur means living a few years of your life in a way that most people won't, so that you can potentially live the rest of your life in a way that most people can't.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big swing, right?
For sure.
So yeah. As you think about entrepreneurship, which you are, so you are a practitioner as well. Give me kind of, in your estimation, maybe three keys, mm-hmm. and maybe there are 10, mm-hmm. but three that you feel good about to entrepreneurship.
Flexibility, creativity, resourcefulness. I think those are the most important three things together to being a successful entrepreneur.
Flexibility, creativity, mm-hmm. resourcefulness. Mm-hmm. Split the hair between resourcefulness and creativity.
Yeah, so in my mind, the resourcefulness is kind of having a network and knowing how to use that network, and also is certainly related to creativity, but that's how I would kind of split that with having a network and using the resources that are available to you and knowing to do that.
What do you think what might be the kiss of death for an entrepreneur?
Caring too much about what other people think.
Okay. Same old stuff, right?
I think so.
Just getting squelches everything. Thinking too much. And one thing I would add to the list is, and I wasn't explicitly asked what I might add, but
I'll ask you, what would you add?
Patience.
Yeah.
Which is all of those things, which is you've got to be patient enough. But it's a little bit like waging a war, right? Which is you're not always attacking. There's a lot of time spent not attacking and making sure that when you do, you win.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And actually, we were talking before this, and I think that there's, I think a lot about I try to ask other people the question too. It's just like, what do you want to do before you die? And what's holding you back from pursuing those goals or those ambitions? And I think so much of what we've been talking about here for the past 5 minutes is rooted in that.
So when you do, is that a rhetorical question to a group? Or do you ask people that and do they answer it?
Oftentimes I think of it, I would love to get answers to it, but it ends up being kind of a rhetorical question.
Right. To a thought to leave them with,
right?
Type of thing.
Yeah.
And do you think that oftentimes the answer in that moment may be like, I don't know?
I think sometimes that's the answer, but also sometimes people have an answer that they don't want to share because like they're scared of it or embarrassed about it or they don't think it's realistic or can't achieve it.
Really? Well, I get that. I mean, I remember when I started Bryzos, people were like, well, what are you up to? Like, I just started a company called Bryzos. They're like, what's a Bryzos? And I always thought of the Beatles, the band, the Beatles is kind of what, because I just thought of like, you know, Paul McCartney and John Lennon, you know, they're parents, their buddies are asking them, like, so you, what's your band? They're like, the Beatles, but it's like B-E-A-T, like Beatle. Yeah. And they're like, yeah, good luck. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. So all things are cool until they're not, are not cool until they are. Mm-hmm. And they just, you just, you just like, yeah, we're good. And I'm not going to worry about it.
But I think you said all things are cool until they are, they're not. And so that perception, the people around you, it's just so important to have that thick skin and be focused and disciplined.
And I would add to it, I said patience, but it's, you said creativity, flexibility, resourcefulness, correct? I added patience. And one thing, and Lee Letourneau here would tell you something I've said since the very beginning, and this is somewhat topical, I guess, in this, or paralleled, which is I always think of Andy Dufresne.
Okay.
From Shawshank Redemption, right?
Yeah.
And read Morgan Freeman's talking about how do you get out of Shawshank State Prison or whatever it was, time and pressure. That's how he escaped, was time and pressure. And I think about that like one little grain at a time. And so long as you're still just time and pressuring that, you're probably going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that focus too, to know where the time, where the pressure as well.
Yeah. So yeah. I guess that's tied up with patience perhaps, but it's also persistence, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And to absolutely. to do things takes time.
Yeah. To do great things takes time for sure.
Yeah, it really does. And the recommendation to an entrepreneur, one of them would be, you know, get organized and just whatever, how long you think that's going to take you, let's at least put a multiplier on it. Because you're, you know, the unmet expectation, it can be very frustrating. You know, you always want to move with purpose and be swift, but, you know, you also don't want to draw a line in the sand that you walked by a year ago and you're like, well, is that a fail? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. What are your biggest challenges at Brizos right now?
You know, it's always month to month sort of thing. But what we've just concluded was a long time period of product to market fit, which is as you're addressing a supply chain, metal supply chain that certainly has evolved over time. I mean, they weren't always using phones and emails. I mean, there was a time before that. So really just getting a product to market fit that the market told us it was right, not by them telling it, because they always tell you, it's great, whatever. But, you know, transactionally speaking, it just speaks for itself. When you're seeing buyers month over month, you know, repeat purchase ratios, you know, north of 75% month over month over month, that's how we know we've nailed it. So we really wrapped that up, and that was the big, I think one of the major lifts was getting something that people use and adopt into their workflow. And then, you know, you moved on to these we move on to the next stages, which is, you know, the scaling of it. Because when you're addressing particularly, I think, supply chain, you're not going to get a lot of chances with that group. Because to a degree, they're not sitting there waiting around for it. So when they give you the time of day to actually look what you've done, you got to nail it. Or they're just going to be like, I knew it. Sucks.
Right. Yeah.
So that was thus far the most difficult thing to do. And then it takes a long time to do that. So that's just a stage of this larger process of getting this in. So there's no one thing that's burning in my head right now of, you know, I the people here are tired of hearing me make this, I guess, metaphor of when you're doing this, think of like a music mixing board, all right? With like a 24-channel mixing board, and you are constantly balancing the faders on that mixing board, you know, and you got to get all of them to the top eventually, but there's a right and a wrong way to keep that balanced. And so you could be leaning into your marketing for a while, and then these faders kind of starting to look like they're falling behind. So you've got to figure out a way that is not reactive to make sure that all of these fronts are moving through time. So that's and I think managing that well does keep any one thing from burning a hole in your head.
Makes sense. Makes sense.
But yeah. I didn't start there.
It took some time to get to that point.
It took some time to get to that point. And the one of my key focuses has always been, I don't want to have every day to be like a 4-alarm fire. Like, how can we address this challenge in a way to create predictability and optics into, and I don't mean just, you know, having like data. I just mean, how can we, this doesn't have to be an insane project where it's just like, every single day. And so that's part, a lot of what I try and do is make sure that we're covering as much ground as we can across all these disciplines in a way that the cadence doesn't cause, it doesn't cause discord. Mm-hmm. So,
yep.
What do you typically hear as an answer to that?
Well, first I was going to say congrats on everything that you've done with Bryzos. We're sitting here in this awesome studio in the office, and it's starting a company is really hard, and you've done it, and it's exciting. So this is awesome.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, of course.
And I'll take a moment to interrupt you quickly, but certainly not alone in this effort. We've got, our team and our investor, like everything that goes into it. And I'm just the one who happens to be sitting at this microphone, but it's a team effort 100%. And getting that team dynamic correct so that nobody sort of makes anyone else boil. And keeping it just like eyes on the objective.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is a difficult thing that's iterative.
Always. Yeah. Yeah.
Highly iterative. So what's next for you? I don't mean you're starting a new business, but what are, as you're thinking about, SGI, what is next for you? What are you trying to get done?
Yeah, so right now my focus is to continue to use this message for good, and that's where I'm at. And at SGI, I talk a lot about building a community of high performers. So adopting this framework or some version of it that can be helpful. So really, my plan is to continue using this story and message to help others. And again, I never could have expected where life was going to go, but here we are, and that's what I'm focused on.
Well, I want to thank you for coming in, Sam, and sharing the story. And I know you do tell it. First of all, you tell it in a compelling way, and again, the book I want people to know about is Saving Sam, and it's a compelling, inspiring story. And I shared with you in a selfish way before we started that reading books similar to, and doesn't have to be an extreme circumstance that you're in, but just hardship is inspiring, because it's like, for me, speaking for me only, when I see something someone else has gotten through, it makes you question and sort of reach, like, can I do that? So thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Shep. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.